What have you ruled out for yourself? Because a past version of you has decided, possibly, probably, with the assistance of some quote-unquote helpful others, that this thing, this couldn't be your thing. This isn't something someone like you could do, or would do, or should do. I went to a coding class back in high school, so mid-1980s, and we were given the simplest of tasks. Write a bit of code that, as I remember it, meant that you'd create the prompt, what's my name, and then you could write in, so like Michael, and then it would say, welcome, Michael. I just didn't get it. The math whizzes on either side of me took about a nanosecond to figure this out, but my logic loop just wasn't looping, or it wasn't logic, or all of the above. What's my name? I'm not sure, but it's certainly not Mr. Coding Whiz. Now, I've got other stories, of course, other moments of elimination, woodworking and the existential crisis I had trying to make a wooden pencil box, and organizing logistics for my first job, which I screwed up. And if I keep poking around, I can find more. It means that I've just assumed that some things aren't for me, and they haven't been for me for 20 or 40 or 5 years. But I wonder now what might be on the other side of this isn't for me, this isn't me. I've been wondering what would happen if I, sprayed some WD-40 on my rusted in settings and moved the dial back from no to maybe, or from no to not yet, but maybe later. Daunting is okay. Daunting is not a reason to say no. But you know, there's actually more to it than this. There's more to it than just, do you think you can do it? And I'm going to riff on this at the end of the show. Welcome to Two Pages with MBS, the podcast where brilliant people read the best two pages from a favorite book, a book that has moved them, a book that has changed them, shaped them. And you can sign up at twopageswithmbs.substack.com and you'll get my short essay and you'll get notice of a new episode every 2 weeks. Members get access to transcripts and the occasional MBS solo episode where I read and discuss two pages from books that have shaped and moved me. I'm not sure we've ever had anybody who self-identifies as a programmer and as a coder on the show, but Kaya Thomas is an app builder, and she cut her teeth with well-known companies like Slack and Calm. Now, when we talked, and it was a bit of a while ago, she was actually in the midst of rebooting her career.
Now I'm actually a full-time student, so switched it over, and I'm at MIT doing a dual degree program, getting my MBA and my Master's of Science in Engineering.
And now she's working for one of the big consultancies. So you might assume that Kaya is one of those STEM types, science, technology, economics, maths, who is all about the numbers and the logic and the code. Possibly not someone who spends time immersed in fantastical science fiction and fantasy worlds. But in fact, Kaya is both a coder and a book lover. And more than that, and this is why I was so excited to have her on the show, she's a coder who's bringing that expertise to help others find books to love as well.
Several years ago, I created an app called We Read Too, which is really my love and passion project. And it's a mobile directory of children and young adult books written by authors of color.
The seed for this was planted early.
Honestly, the idea for not an app, but a resource came to me when I was in high school. I was an avid reader. I've always been an avid reader. And I started to realize that the books that I was being assigned to in school and I was being exposed to at my local library weren't diverse. There wasn't a lot of diverse representation in the books. And so I started doing my own research and I realized that there were some books out there. And I knew that it would be so great if there was one resource where folks could easily access and figure out what these books are. And right. So I had that idea, but I didn't know how to code back then.
Right.
And so when I got to college and I started learning how to program and realized that with software engineering, you can create things out in the world, I knew, okay, I can create an app.
what I'm curious to know what tipped you into action, because there's lots of people who have those brief moments where you go, this is annoying, or this is frustrating, or this isn't fair, you know, kind of those potential sparks that could lead to the creation of something. And many people, and I'm one of them, go, yeah, I could do something about it, or I could just go and have a cup of tea instead, and that's easier. What were the first steps you took that got you going on this journey? What actually put you from idea into action?
I think a lot of it was actually the joy and love of programming that I had.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because when I first started learning how to program, I took my first course. It was a course called Programming Through Interactive Art. So I first really learned programming through a context of creativity and art, which is a very, I think, different lens than a lot of people are introduced to something like programming and coding. And so for me, I viewed coding as a tool for creativity, a tool for creation. And so I just loved creating things with code. And so when I started to learn about iOS development, and I always loved Apple and iPhones and mm-hmm. things like that. And so once I started to learn the tools to be able to create apps, I was like, okay, not only can I do something that I enjoy and that's fun and I can create something, I can make an impact and I can make something that's really meaningful to me and communities.
I also want to ask you about coding, because I know you're an avid reader. You told us that. Now, I'm an avid reader as well. And I tend to kind of think like there are two types of people in the world. There are people who read books and there are coders. And it's because I'm on one side, which is like, oh, I like literature and words. And then coders, I'm like, oh, it's kind of scary and weird and logical, and I don't get that. Can you tell me about the magic of coding in a way that somebody who's scared of it and scared of STEM a little bit could understand?
Definitely. I personally love to break down those barriers and myths. I think a lot of times folks think that in order to be a programmer and to code that you need to be this mathematical genius.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And you need to be this
definitely
person.
Definitely not me.
And that's not the case. I think when we just think about writing, right? Writing is a tool to express ourselves.
Yeah.
And we love reading, right? Because you're reading someone's expression of the world, of life, and it's a beautiful thing. And coding can be that same beauty and that same magic. It's just different. Is you're writing code than to build something, create something, give the computer or phone some type of guide, instructions, so that people can interact with that technology in a really fun way, in a great way. And so I view writing and coding very similarly. I think just like people have a writing style, there's a coding style, right? And just in ways you write in your own way, you can code in a unique way. And I think when you're creating and building something, you're building a system, it's very much, do you think about like outlining and plotting a book? There's a lot of parallels there. And
that's
so
cool.
I would say to folks who are a little bit scared of that
right.
area, you know, don't be. It can be really fun and creative. You don't have to be a math genius in order to be a programmer.
How would you describe your voice in coding? I mean, you know, they say authors have a certain writing voice. You know, if somebody was to look at your coding style, what words would they use to describe it?
I would hope that they use words like it's very understandable, mm-hmm. it's very approachable, it's very readable, it's simple.
Right.
I think that's another thing with programming. Sometimes folks have the tendency to over-engineer, just like in writing, right? Sometimes simple can be great. You don't need to have long sentences and whatnot. It can be that concise nature that can be really impactful and powerful. And I think it's the same thing with coding.
Speaking of people with distinct voices, tell me about the book that you've chosen for us today.
Yes, so I've chosen Blood Child and Other Stories by Octavia Butler.
Perfect. And I'm so excited you have. You know, Octavia Butler is our first returning author And I wouldn't have put money on that being the case. But we've had another guest too, Xavier Butler, a different book to read from. But what was it about this author and this book that means so much to you?
Definitely. So Octavia Butler is my favorite author, and I first discovered her back in high school, and it was the first time that I ever read a science fiction book by a Black woman, and the first time there was science fiction characters in a book that were Black. And I love science fiction. It's my favorite genre. And so for me, it was the first moment I really felt seen in the genre that I loved so much. Yeah. And so, and it's one of the reasons why, right, I created We Read Too. And so she, her work is just so meaningful to me. And this book specifically, it's a short stories and essays, and getting to read her essays to me was like, wow, I'm getting a peek into her, her mind and her experience and her journey. And because I've looked up to her so much, it was very refreshing to read about her struggles and the things that she went through to become the prolific author that she is.
Are you able to share any of that? I mean, I don't know much about her story. I know that she was this pioneering Black woman writing science fiction when there weren't other Black voices. I know that NASA named the crater where the new Mars visit arrived after her, which is fantastic. So she's been in the news there. Yes. But I don't really know about the experience she had trying to write when she was on the margins. Are you able to share some of that with us?
Yes, definitely. So Octavia Butler, she grew up poor, essentially. Her mother was a domestic worker, and her mother saved up to buy her a typewriter. And she knew she wanted to be a writer from like the age of 10. She always wanted to write stories, and she started writing from a very young age and entered into like writing competitions when she was in high school. She had a teacher who was really supportive of her, and I think it shows that importance of mentorship and sponsorship, right? And she just kept trying. She worked in a factory for a while she was writing, and she said she would just get up in the mornings, right, early and write. And eventually in her 20s is when she was able to get her first writing published. And, you know, she got so many rejections.
Yeah.
So many rejections, but she just kept persevering.
Oh, there's so many good things out of that. I want to hear the two pages you picked for us, but your comment about her having a teacher that was such an important guide for her. Has there been somebody in your life that's been a kind of a mentor or a guide like that, who's been that kind of beacon of what's possible?
There's been so many, and I'm very, very grateful for that. I think because especially in the field I am in, technology, there is a lower population of Black women that are in the field. But because of that, I think that we have our community and we support each other. And so when I was getting into technology and STEM, I was able to reach out to the women that I looked up to, you know, reached out to them online and actually build real relationships with them and be able to receive mentorship from them. So I've been very grateful for that.
So what have you learned about what it takes to be a good mentor? You know, what are the characteristics that have been so valuable to you?
I think a good mentor listens, right? I think that a lot of folks think, you know, when you're a mentor, you're just doling out advice. And that's not really what it's about, right? I think a good mentor listens and understands what the person that they're mentoring really needs, where they're trying to go in their journey, and help them just guide them and help them shape their goals, right? And for me, I think that's what's been really helpful is sometimes you just need that listening ear or that person to help bounce ideas off of or help solidify your ideas and make them, you know, feel real.
Yeah. Kaya, how did you pick two pages to read? I mean, you love Octavia Butler. It's her favorite author. You got short stories and essays in this book. How did you choose what to read to us today?
I was I knew I think I wanted to choose from her essays. So she has fiction short stories in the book, but I knew I wouldn't be able to pick just two pages from one of the stories and do it justice. So I knew that I wanted to pick two pages from one of her essays. And so I really just picked the two pages that I think for me really impacted me and helped me understand her on a deeper level.
Beautiful. And what's the name of the essay?
So this essay is called Positive Obsession.
Oh, I already love that as a title. I want to write a book called Positive Obsession. It sounds so great. Well, look, let me do a formal introduction. So Kaya Thomas, software engineer and also creator of the We Read 2 app, is reading from Octavia Butler's nonfiction essay, Positive Obsession. Kaya, over to you.
There seems to be an unwritten rule, hurtful and at odds with the realities of American culture. It says you aren't supposed to wonder whether, as a Black person, a Black woman, you might really be inferior, not quite bright enough, not quite quick enough, not quite good enough to do the things you want to do. Though, of course, you do wonder. You're supposed to know you're as good as anyone. And if you don't know, you aren't supposed to admit it. If anyone near you admits it, you're supposed to reassure them quickly so they'll shut up. That sort of talk is embarrassing. Act tough and confident and don't talk about your doubts. If you never deal with them, you may never get rid of them, but no matter, fake everyone out, even yourself. I couldn't fake myself out. I didn't talk much about my doubts. I wasn't fishing for hasty reassurances, but I did a lot of thinking the same things over and over. Who was I anyway? Why should anyone pay attention to what I had to say? Did I have anything to say? I was writing science fiction and fantasy, for God's sake. At that time, nearly all professional science fiction writers were white men. As much as I loved science fiction and fantasy, what was I doing? Well, whatever it was, I couldn't stop. Positive obsession is about not being able to stop just because you're afraid and full of doubts. Positive obsession is dangerous. It's about not being able to stop at all. I was 23 when, finally, I sold my first two short stories. I sold both to writer-editors who were teaching at Clarin, a science fiction writer's workshop that I was attending. One story was eventually published. The other wasn't. I didn't sell another word for 5 years. Then, finally, I sold my first novel. Thank God no one told me selling would take so long. Not that I would have believed it. I've sold 8 novels since then. Last Christmas, I paid off the mortgage on my mother's house.
That's wonderful. You know, it speaks to feelings that everybody has, I think, but particularly kind of heightened if you're a Black woman, particularly heightened if you're a Black woman in a field that is not necessarily welcoming or used to Black women being in there.
Definitely.
Do you feel that you have positive obsession?
I do. I do feel like I have positive obsession. I think for me, it doesn't always manifest in like one particular skill.
Right.
Because for me, being I'm not trying to be the best programmer ever or the best software engineer. But I think for me, it's more project-based.
Right.
Well, I want to create things and I want to create impactful things and put them out into the world. And so once I kind of hone in on that project or idea, I definitely have that positive obsession.
So how do you figure out what to obsess about, what to hone in on? Because there's so much to do. I'm curious to know how you know when you've landed on something that's worth committing to.
That's such a great question. That's such a great question. For me, I think it's gotten harder over the years. I think in the beginning, when I had the beginner's naivete, it was much easier because I didn't know what I didn't know. And so I think now, really, when I think about what is really worth my time, what do I need to kind of focus that positive obsession on, I think about not only how it's going to help me grow,
yeah,
but how I can maybe eventually use it to empower others or help others grow or learn something or, you know, be aware of something. I think for me, I try to make sure that it's beyond myself.
Right. So you recently stopped your career as a coder and went back to school. You know, you're studying this dual master's degree at MIT.
Yes.
When was the moment when you went, I've got a career and I'm stepping away from the career to go back to school? How did you decide to commit to that? It feels like a big thing. Like the obvious thing would be to double down on your career at the moment, I would have thought.
Definitely. It was the pandemic. Right. I think you'll probably, I'm sure, hear this a lot from folks, right? These shifts, life yeah. shifts after this, you know, 2020 was just a whirlwind of a year. And so for me, it made me really think about my career in the sense of, was being a software engineer professionally really utilizing my full potential?
Right.
And I came to the conclusion that no, I wasn't really utilizing my full potential. I love programming. It's something that I thoroughly enjoy, but I know I have so much more to give to the world. And I have a lot of skills outside of programming. And so I want to be able to build a career around that, being able to fully utilize that potential.
So, you know, one of the phrases that struck me from the piece that you read, which was like, you know, fake everybody out, you know, pretend you've got it together.
Yes.
And Octavia Butler saying, you know, I couldn't fake everybody out. I didn't want easy reassurance. What doubts show up for you? And how do you sit with those doubts?
For me, I will say, like with reading Octavia saying like she couldn't fake everyone out, that was impactful for me because I felt like I did a lot of faking in terms of making people think that maybe I didn't have doubts.
Right.
And I realized that, you know, once I'm having conversations with some young folks who are looking up to me and wanting to do the things that I've done and thinking that I'm perfect or that, you know, that could never be me.
Yeah.
And so for me, a lot of the doubts, you know, early on, especially when I was trying to build my expertise was, you know, am I smart enough to do this job?
Yeah.
Do I, you know, really know what I'm doing? And even with Reread 2, right? Is the app good enough? Is, you know,
right.
Is it doing the things that I want it to do? I think sometimes, you know, you get those kind of negative voices and mindset, especially when I think for me, when you're so few, when you're not really seeing a lot of folks who are in your field. And so you wonder like, you know, how long can I succeed in this? Where is my ceiling, right? Everyone talks about the glass ceiling, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think those are the doubts that really formed for me.
Right. And how would you articulate, you know, the price you pay for being in that place of kind of faking everybody out? What's the cost of that to you?
There are so many costs. I think for me, some of them is my own mental health because I think I put a lot of pressure on myself. I think because oftentimes I'm the only one of whatever, whether it's the only Black woman, whether it's the only woman, whether it's the only Black person. And so I put a lot of pressure on myself because I think, oh, I'm the representation and I need to, you know, be that good role model. I need to make sure that I'm succeeding. And so it's really not great for my mental health. And I think the other cost that it has is for folks who I'm trying to hopefully bring up, right, behind me. And if they think that, you know, I don't have any doubts or everything has gone smoothly for me, that's doing them a disservice, right? Because it's going to be hard for them if they think that, oh, she's successful and never had any doubts or problems and I'm having problems, they think, oh, I can't make it.
Right. Perpetuates a lie of how easy this thing is when it's not. You know, a previous guest of ours, Minda Hartz, wrote about what it's like to be the only one. What is that like? You know, I don't experience that because I'm a, you know, I'm a straight white man. I'm like, there's never an only that. So what is it like to be the only one, whether you're the only woman or the only black woman or whatever it might be?
Exactly. It's very isolating. I think it can be isolating and frustrating. I think that sometimes you feel like you can't bring your full identity into certain spaces. And so I think it's a really big mental load that you're constantly thinking of, oh, well, if I say this, are they going to think this? Or if I do this, are they going to think that? So I think it really weighs on you when you are the only. And I think especially in a work context, right, we're thinking about work. It's a lot of times when you think about folks who are able to make it to really high levels, a lot of it is about relationships and networking. And so sometimes it feels like, can I ever build those type of relationships? And because you're not the same, and it can be really difficult.
You know, one of the lines that struck me from the piece you read from Octavia Butler was the question, well, who am I anyway? And just to kind of connect that to what the last thing you said, which is like, you don't always feel you can bring your full identity to the experience. What is your full identity? How would you describe that? And how would you say that's different from how it might show up in certain contexts? I know this is really a personal question, but it's such a vibrant language that you use.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I think, you know, my full identity is a mixture of so many things. I'm a New Yorker. I'm a Black woman. I'm, you know, the granddaughter of Southern Black folks. I am a daughter. I am a niece. Yeah. I am a sister. There's so many facets, I think, when I think about my identity and how it makes me who I am today.
Yeah. Kaya, you've got this side hustle going, the We Read 2 project, and you've been doing it for 7 years. You launched it in 2014. That's a long time.
Yes. it is.
What have you learned about sustaining a project like that? Because not many side projects last that long. Not many side projects manage to generate the kind of the ongoing commitment and the ongoing, I'm still there, I'm still part of this. What have you learned about that?
Definitely. I think the number one thing I learned is you have to be okay with taking a break from it. I think early on for the first couple of years, I felt really guilty if I wasn't able to work on it for a few months or if I was just too busy. And I felt like, oh my gosh, I'm letting everyone down and what have you. But I had to realize that, like, for that long-term sustainability, it's okay to take those breaks. And it's okay to not spend, you know, every week, every month just thinking about it or working on it. And I think that's why a lot of people don't sustain side projects, because they feel like they have to commit so much to it. And that's not always the case. I think it's okay to take it easy.
And how do you think about success for a project like this?
For me, with Reread 2, the success is really whenever I hear from parents or guardians or family members that are able to find new books where their, you know, the youth and kids in their life are represented, or when I hear from white parents who have now exposed their children to books where children are all from all different types of backgrounds. When I hear from teachers that are expanding their classroom libraries. And so for me, really, success just looks like, you know, more young kids being exposed to these books, because it's important, I think, for all children, no matter their background, to read these types of stories and to realize that difference can be celebrated. And it's okay that we're different, but you can learn and read about other cultures and read about kids who are different from you. And that's important too.
So what I noticed from that, Kaya, is how grounded that is as a definition of success. It's like small victories, small but significant victories. And you could have come at that answer all sorts of ways, which is like 1 billion reviews on the app store, or you know, I scale it up so it's got a gazillion users, or and you've worked with Slack and you've worked with Calm, which are both big apps. I mean, they're huge in terms of the kind of the presence they have and the people that they touch. Or you could be going, look, I'm looking to cash out and make my millions on this app. and you've said none of those things. Why aren't they tempting?
I think for me, especially because I've worked in tech and I've seen folks aspiring for those very specific things, I realize that oftentimes when you're just focused on scaling and growth and making it bigger and bigger, you lose sight of why you started in the first place.
Right.
And you lose sight of what the purpose of it is supposed to be. So for me, WeRead 2 is a resource, and it's a free resource. And I always intend to keep it as a free resource. It's not, an income generating thing for me, and that's not the purpose.
Yeah.
I'm amazed and honored that so many people have downloaded it and used it. And I would love for more people to be exposed to it, but I'm not going to, be tracking those metrics. I need 1,000,000 people to, download it. That's not what it's about. I want to hear from the people who are actually using it and who's actually it's impacted. And that's what it's about for me. I don't want to lose sight of that, because when you start thinking all about that growth and scaling, I think it's really easy to lose sight of the purpose.
You've gone back to school. I'm curious to know what you have had to unlearn and relearn in being a student again.
Yes. I think I've had to relearn to an extent the juggling and the mental juggling of learning several things at once.
Right.
I think, when you are working as a professional, you usually have a very specific focus in your job. And so you're very focused on learning in that specific way. Mm-hmm. And so now being a student again and taking all these courses and different things and having to expand my mind in different ways, I'm just having to learn how to learn several things in parallel. And so that's been a skill. I think unlearning, I think unlearning a little bit of how I approach school way back when I was an undergrad and in high school. I think I approached school then as like, okay, I'm a student. Like, I need to get my good grades. I need to, school. Like, and anything else you do, anything outside of school or something for school, you feel guilty, right? If you watch a Netflix show, you're like, oh my God, I'm so guilty. I should have studied for that hour.
Right.
And so I had to unlearn that in the sense of coming now as an adult who has a working professional experience.
Yeah.
When I was working, I could shut off work and then go about my life. And it's the same thing now with school. It's like, yes, I'm going to study. I'm going to do what I need to do, but I can shut it off and also live my life.
Introductory essay is very much in the vein of feel the fear and notice the fear and work through the fear. And all of that is useful self-help mantra and practice. When I recently walked up Cotopaxi, this ridiculously high volcano in Ecuador, I kept doing something similar. I kept saying to myself, Michael's okay, this is okay, everything's okay, keep going. But what's so illuminating for me about Kaya's choice of pages to read and in her story is that self-help is often blind to context. It's often decontextualized. So when Octavia Butler writes, "Who was I anyway? Why should anyone pay attention to what I had to say? Did I have anything to say?" She's not just saying that as a writer, because by the way, pretty much every writer thinks that at some stage. She's saying that as a Black woman writing science fiction when there were no other Black women writing science fiction. And it makes me think, I'm wondering, as someone who has had a lot of role models showing me what's possible, I'm a white man, straight white man after all, what might my role now be in helping others be first, or be second, or be tenth, helping to clear the way and open the space and shine the light for people who are showing that their it, whatever that it might be, can be done by someone like them. If you enjoyed my conversation with Kaya, I've got this time three episodes to recommend. First of all, Minda Hearts, one of the very early episodes, episode number 6. She actually was the first person who read from Octavia Butler from one of her most famous books called Kindred. That episode is called A Seat at the Table. And that Minda's work is very much about helping Black women be seen in different places, particularly in the boardroom. You might also like episode 32, How to Be World Positive, by Swata Mailarevarapu. And she read from Ghost Work, which is about how Silicon Valley is developing. Swati is a Rhodes Scholar, an activist, an investor. She's changing the world on her own terms, which I deeply admire. And then I might finally recommend David Robertson, episode 52, To Read is to Change. You can see the connection between David's perspective and Kaya's work. And he read from Tom's Midnight Garden. David's a well-known author in Canada, Indigenous man, and an excellent conversation. If you'd like more of Kaya, she's on GitHub. So GitHub/KMT901. GitHub.com/KMT901. You can support the podcast by signing up for the Substack newsletter, which I mentioned at the top of the show, and joining as a paid member if you'd like the cool bonuses. You can help by recommending episodes you love to people you like, and you can help by leaving a review if you're so moved. Doing any one of those things is lovely. Doing more than one, thoroughly delightful, thoroughly appreciated. You're awesome, and you're doing great.